This evening, of course, is not only to introduce to you the work of Susan Eisenberg, but also it's my job every year to call up the spirit of Larry Levis in some way or another. And this is what I was thinking about today when I was thinking about Larry. Every year I ask him to help me. And you know, he never fails to come through. There are a number of great poets who were great walkers, and perhaps that is no accident. William Wordsworth comes to mind immediately with his lifelong habit of walking throughout the Lake District. Even when he left home as a young man to travel in revolutionary France, it was for a walking tour. And one of his first volumes of poetry was titled An Evening Walk. Wallace Stevens also comes to mind. Stevens walked every morning from home to his work at the Hartford Accident and Indemnity Company. Now we call it the Hartford Insurance Company. And in the evening, he walked back home again. On those walks, he composed poetry. It's impossible to ignore the likelihood that those walks introduced a certain kind of rhythm, as well as a certain set of favorite images, as a characteristic of his poetry. Walking and poetry seem wedded to each other for so many poets. Walking seems to be an activity that opens the mind to necessary invention and intervention, and it offers the necessary speed for observing the necessary landscape. When I first met with Larry Levis to talk with him about the possibility of his taking up a position here at VCU, one that had opened up when Dave Smith left to join the faculty at LSU and take up editing the Southern Review, we got together at a bar in Salt Lake City, Utah. That's where Larry was teaching at the time, University of Utah. I was there on my way to a white water rafting adventure with the writer Pam Houston. She had concocted this thing for me, and I took advantage of the chance to sit down with Larry and, to be honest, try to sell him on the idea of coming to Richmond and join the faculty here. Sadly, I'm a person who is late for every appointment, despite my very best of intentions, as my friends and students well know. Yet Larry, characteristically, was always even later than me, a trait in him I naturally appreciated. So I was sitting there in the bar when I heard a roar, and I had the chance to watch this tall, cool cat who looked like he would be at home anywhere stroll into the bar and stick out his hand. I had long ago given up riding motorcycles, and I didn't envy Larry that coolness factor, since I had lost several good friends to motorcycling accidents, yet I had to admit that his having a bike made an impression on me. What I didn't know was that at that time, it was his only mode of transportation, as he reveals in his poem, Two Trees. I still had two friends, but they were trees. One was a box elder, the other a horse chestnut. I used to stop on my way home and talk to each of them. The three of us lived in Utah then, though we never learned why me, Asar Nagundo, and the other one, whose name I can never remember. Everything I have done has come to nothing. It is not even worth mocking, I would tell them, and then I would look up into their limbs and see how they were covered in ice. You do not even have a car anymore, one of them would answer. By the time Larry reached Richmond, he did not even have a motorcycle anymore, and so he walked. I did not know he didn't have a car for a long time. I assumed he had one. And when the weather was particularly bad, when I finally found that out, I would offer him a ride, and he almost always refused. He liked the walk, he said. Larry walked from his home in Churchill, down through Shaco Bottom, and up towards his office here on the academic campus in Richmond's Fan District, and in the evening, he would walk home again. Now, if you visit the Hartford Friends and Enemies of Wallace Stevens website, you will discover there is a movement underway to create something called the Wallace Stevens Walk, which will consist of 13 stone markers installed along the 2 miles Stevens walk from home to office. Each marker will have one stanza from 13 ways of looking at a blackbird. Carbon. I'm not making this up. You will also discover there that already the friends and enemies of Wallace Stevens have laid out the Wallace Stevens walking tour, complete with a map and highlighted sites along the walk, and each of those sites have been presented online with a photograph accompanied with some text explaining the significance of that place. So here's the map and the site and everything. You can go visit this and find out about this thing yourself. And what you'll find is photographs there, and it says things like Hartford Accident and Indemnity Building. Stevens worked in executive row on the first floor to the right of the entrance. So I guess you can go stand there and look at the door that he walked through and imagine him walking through the door. There's a photograph of his house, 118 Westerly Terrace. In 1932, Stevens bought the only house he ever owned for cash, leaving himself house poor at the height of the Depression. Elizabeth Park, one of Stevens' favorite Hartford haunts. So I thought that we, the friends of Larry Levis, I don't know if there are any enemies of Larry Levis here. If there are, keep quiet. Or I hope you're really good enemies of Larry Levis. But maybe we want to create the Larry Levis Walk. I was trying to figure out what poem we would use to carve into those stones along that walk all the way down there. What we put on the stones? And I suppose a good nominee might be the poem you ask for. Since the markers would not only have great lines carved into them, but they would be both inexplicable and hilarious, just as Larry would want them to be. So they would have things carved on them like the first one would say, "My poem would eat nothing." And I'd love to see people just standing there looking at that, trying to figure out, what the devil does that mean? The next one would say, "I tried giving it water, but it said no." Any number of things might be on those stones, but it's perhaps frightening to think of downtown. There might be a stone that the business folk down there would be puzzling over. They'd be reading it, trying to figure out what it meant. "I offered it all my money, my clothes, my car with a full tank, but the poem stared at the floor." And there they would be puzzling over that, but we would have the last laugh because we knew that Larry didn't even have a car. He said that he didn't. Most of the time, he lived here in Richmond, he didn't have a car, and even when he had a car, he still didn't have a car. The car that he had, you could see the road through the floorboards, and it was extremely dangerous to ride around in it with him, you know. And one of the last things, the last experiences I had with Larry was going and helping him find a tire for that thing. It had no spare. And the first thing that happened, I said to him, "Larry, you have no spare. Do you have a jack?" "Yes, but I broke it." I said, "Larry, how did you break a jack?" He said, "My friend Boots, who's here with me, he broke it." So I went there in a car I just bought that had a jack in the back, and I drove up, and we put it under the car, and Boots broke that jack, too. Had to go home and get another jack, you know. So he was dangerous around cars, just dangerous. So one can imagine also that there might be a stone way down there in Shaco Bottom from the end of the poem that would say something dangerous like, "And the poem demanded the food. It drank up all the water, beat me and took my money, tore the faded clothes off my back, said, shit." Of course, we wouldn't want to see what was in front of that stone there down the bottom. Somebody might take that as a command or something. But we don't have to wait on the carving of the stones to set up the Larry Levis walking tour, just as the friends and enemies of Wallace Stevens have done. So first of all, there would be, we can set this up on a website, and there's a picture of the Hibbs Building, you know, where he suffered through the bad air. You know, what kind of a little explanation of the Hibbs Building could we possibly put there? The Hibbs Building, which won awards from architects as the first building in Richmond that should be torn down. And then the various sites along the way, including Bell's Tavern, where he wrote quite a few poems, the little plaque for Bell's Tavern. And I'll get to that again in just a minute. Perhaps one of the sites that would be memorialized would be the street that he lived on, and we'd put a plaque up there where he was mugged. When Larry was mugged, He had no cash on him. And we'd have to find a way to carve all this on the stone, maybe, if we put a stone up there. He had no cash on him, so he offered to write the mugger a check. And then maybe we would put another plaque up outside the Hill Cafe. That would be the real joke on the mugger. Not that, because Larry probably would never have ratted him out to the police. He probably would have written him a check and they would have kept quiet about it. Unfortunately for the mugger, as everyone in the Hill Cafe who loved Larry, he was a wonderful customer there, but they all knew that he wrote nothing but bad checks. Perhaps we would then put a plaque outside of his house in Churchill, the one that he loved so much. He loved it because it was so old. And he loved the place, the spirit in the place. And Larry Levis actually really did enjoy his time in Richmond and enjoyed living here. It was one of the things that I went and told his family after his death about all the things that he enjoyed about living in Richmond, including his walks back and forth from way up here to way out there in Churchill. Last year I read to you, if any of you came last year, from the essay Bell's Tavern that he had written about that place down the Shaco Bottom, which you can find there underneath all the expressway overpasses and everything. Kind of a ridiculous place, really. Something that you would think would be an inspiration for anything but poetry. And here is a poem that he wrote, previously unpublished poem. So one of the things I always try to offer to people who come to these readings every year, this event every year, is something you might not get any other way than coming to this event. An unpublished poem by Larry Levis called The Space. The truth is, the whispered shape of his death is too loud to hear. It's in the sound of traffic overhead, like a sawmill's whir, the moment after the lumber passes through it, changes into time, into charred houses, where the linen was stripped from beds and lace from dresses to bandage time together and hold it still for one more moment. It began as no more than a joke with one wing that flew in circles through the smoke and talk of infinity assembled in Bell's Tavern. Look around. There's nothing left of it. The wind leans against the girders, flange after gray-green flange that frames what's left. A hush of space beneath a freeway overpass, singed air and asphalt, where you can trace a pattern in the shattered glass of a green bottle, or read a destiny in spit before it dries, or bear witness to a drunk guy lurching to a stop as if to confer with a god who swirls around him in a windblown gust of trash, slow waltz of grit when the body isn't there, flesh becoming pine, and a water that tastes like leather. Who would ever have thought the body could be poured like anything else? Who would have supposed the body pouring out of the body in the stench of resurrection? One whiff of it, and you wouldn't be able ever again to live with yourself. You'd live with it as though it were someone else. A woman I once knew asked a grave digger about exhuming remains, moving the dead from one place to another. The grave digger was neither old nor young. He'd just been out of work too long. It was the only job he could get, he said. He had intended to move on after a few months, but then he was drinking a Coke and resting. What's in the coffins, she asked him, when, you know, you open them up. He looked at her briefly. Just hair, he answered. Just miles and miles of hair. If the soul is just the story that it tells, then did his answer, his smile, the way he took his comb out of his back pocket and slicked his hair back, spite the soul with something like the soul? And who really gives a shit? Except those who, like children, who hoped a story never ends, and gather to watch a fermented body pouring from a chalice, or the boy who wished to stay awake forever, and who, with matches and a spoon, after a while, found a way to do just that. They found him, face white and thin, almost as a communion host, dead in the little swan boat in the park, one foot dangling in the water of the pond. My account of him is not a cautionary tale. As far as I'm concerned, he made it. I could feel death in that space where Booth, who was, as far as anyone can tell, a space himself, or avenging angel, or absence, planned the assassination with two friends. And so what if I could? The drunk was talking soundlessly, and the traffic went on overhead. I rubbed my hand across my eyes as if to free them from what fettered them like a hawk's in a king's hand. And when I opened them a second later, the drunk was gone. The king was dead. I could see the nothing in the space it ruled. Beside it there, a small plaque, almost illegible, commemorating the wrong thing, the recruitment of soldiers, sailors, shiftless drunks, debtors, guys out of work, who fought the War of 1812, and then the Mexican War, and then, but after that, the meadows turned to blood. What happened after that was genocide. The self sounds like a guy raking leaves off his walk. It sounds like the scrape of the rake. The soul is just a story the scraping tells. The self has no story. It is a sound. It scrapes against all things. He lets the rake do all the talking now. The raked walk keeps the stars from blowing out in the night sky above his house. It isn't music that he hears. The sore screech of the wheel in the attic's voice, who, having kicked it, becomes the quiet shape the shadow of his body makes. A rhythm only, 2/4 time, without a melody. The flesh, a lighter gray, around the scar, the stitches left. Sore screech of the wheel that never rests. Thin girl at her loom. Thin girl at her loom. It's my pleasure also now to introduce Susan Eisenberg, whose book Muse was a finalist in the Crab Orchard Award series in poetry, and therefore was published by Southern Illinois University Press. While that's Miss Eisenberg's first full-length collection, she is also the author of a chapbook of poems called Peru. And she is also the co-editor with Erin Bellew of The Extraordinary Tide, New Poetry by American Women. Her poems have appeared or are forthcoming in poems all across the country. And without further delay, I'd like to introduce to you someone I'm looking forward to hear read very much, Susan Eisenberg.